All right, today is, what is today?
January 16th.
Yes, January 16th, 2014. This is the third and final interview with Bob Mitchell. We are here in his office inside Ag Hall on the campus of UW-Madison, and I'm Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives. Bob, as we've done for each interview, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Bob Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L.
All right, I'm going to get this just a touch closer to you. Turn up the mic gain just a touch.
How are we now?
Better.
Awesome.
And so I'm going to have to project my voice a little bit so I'm not yelling at you. I'm just making sure my questions get on the record. So you have a list in front of you. I have a list in front of you. The brief bio you gave me as we started this talked about editing research reports for CALS and Extension, and then also editing and writing some brochures for student recruits and for public info efforts. I'm guessing that's just something that was just part of your job, or did you sort of make that part of your job?
Oh, that was part of the job. Yeah, back in those days, everything was on paper. Everything was on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, the college had a series of research reports that were basically things that people, for one reason or another, they were too big or not appropriate for a referee journal, and then so we'd write those up. They'd write them up, and we'd edit them and get them. We had a design and printing operation over in Hiram Smith Hall, and so we would get the manuscripts, we would edit them down, and either get them printed over there, laid out and printed over there, or else they would contract with an outside printer to get that done, and they were anything from four pagers to, there was one that was, when I got my job, I came in and there was a manuscript that was sitting on the bottom shelf of a bookcase of my predecessor, and that manuscript was about 15 inches tall. That was like this, the job that was horrible. He never got finished. I never got finished. It was about the, I forget what it was ag economics, and it was brutal. But so there was a lot of that kind of, there was a fair amount of that kind of work being done. Well, so we were working for both Extension and the college, and Extension reports were, that was just kind of a stock and trade of Extension. It still is, but in those days they were all on paper, and they had a whole series and just about everything they did, and agricultural and family living and food safety, all that kind of stuff. And so we those were much more heavily edited, much more generally, you know, even if they were technical, like I did one every year on tax management for farmers, but still it was geared toward people who were not experts in the field, so we'd edit those things down and get those printed up. Those were all long reports mostly. Some of the, I guess the Extension fact sheets were shorter things, but then that was a big piece of it. And that was kind of a regular amount of work. And then we always had, we did recruiting brochures for the college. Every department had a two-fold flyer brochure that they could take out and that would be stuck in racks. And then we did a large college-wide recruiting brochure that was just, you know, all about the reasons to come to CALS, all the majors and everything here. And then there's just whatever kind of came over the transom. There are always, you know, there would be brochures about the college, just general things, just little short things. And did a publication. In fact, I need to redo it before I finish up for the Ag Research Stations. It's called Where Good Ideas Grow. I came up with that name, and I thought that was pretty appropriate for it. And it goes through and talks about all the stations, dozen or so stations around the state. So Wolfgang Hoffman, our photographer, and I traveled around the state. He went to all the stations. I went to most of them. We got photos for it and wrote that up. And they're actually still using, we've been through a couple iterations of that. They're still using one of them, even though one of the stations has been retired since then. So that's going to be my final big publication job, is getting that one done one more time.
Okay.
So a variety of things like that.
So I'm guessing the short answer to this is it depends, but were these things sent to you you would edit them and then send them back to authors for approval, or was it would come to you, you would do whatever sort of editing, proofreading, and then they would go out?
Well, we always sent them back to authors. Yeah, we would never, excuse me, we would never do a manuscript without having the expert okay the thing. And, you know, generally lots of times the authors were really grateful for what you did. Sometimes you would completely rework the things, and sometimes you'd do a pretty light edit depending on how bad they were and how how important the job was and what the audience was. But not uncommonly you'd edit them pretty thoroughly, and some people got their backs up about that because they thought they were insulted by that, but I think most people realize that you're adding value and making the stuff more approachable. And sometimes they would tell you that their writing got better over the years because you edited the same thing, and they saw the same thing, and they realized that they were repeating themselves, so you'd take it out. So it had a lot to do. I established a lot of relationships with a lot of experts over time, and a lot of them, they appreciate the value you add to their job. So
in a sense, it's like being a editor of a journal or a magazine, except it's sort of individual one-offs. So this manuscript would come to you, you would review it, edit it, send it back to them, they'd approve. There might be some give and take, but eventually it comes back to you, and then you run it through the steps to publish it.
Right. Sometimes it would be as much a rewrite as anything else, which happens with magazine editors too. But yeah, there'd be give and take back and forth. Then we'd get the thing into production. It took a long time. People were always honked off because their publications were taking a long time to get done, because we had four or five or six editors in the various program areas. We had basic science people, natural resource people, social sciences, family living, home ec and family living. So we had a limited number of designers, and it was so the printing publication process took a long time.
How did the, in general, how did the queue go? By that I mean, if somebody sent something to you, I assume you didn't have to wait for that. You'd send it back. I assume you didn't have, well, let me try it. Let's see, what am I trying to say? Let's put it this way. Are there things that had to go out at certain times? You talk about how things might have gone.
Yeah, there were things that had to go out at certain times. We did some periodicals, some things that were on a regular basis, because you know we did I probably mentioned before, we did the Cal's Quarterly, which never came out quarterly, but it was supposed to be a periodical, so it was supposed to come out on a schedule. And there were also timely publications. We had a plant sciences editor, and every year they'd revise all the plant sciences stuff. And, you know, some of that stuff stays current, but some of that stuff doesn't. You know, when they're talking about new seed varieties or new crop chemical stuff like that, they'd have to redo those. So there'd be a big push every year to get those done, and they would have to be done by the beginning of the season or sooner. So that stuff would have to go first. But a lot of give and take there. A lot of, again, people got honked off. It was not a perfect system. It was always a point of irritation for authors, and nobody, you know, in most cases, people weren't always that satisfied. If it was something for the dean, yeah, that'd get done right away, presumably because they wanted it done right away. But
so again, sort of get back to making it the equivalent of a, you know, being a journal editor or a magazine editor. So I'm guessing the bottleneck sometimes could be at the author's desk, because they may be checking out your stuff. It could be in one of your editor's desks, and it also could be a production, because
there's a chronic issue anytime you're doing a publication. In fact, this one we're doing now, the Stats Wisconsin Agriculture, is the same way. Everybody's a little bit pokey, and then you get to the very end, and you're like, come on, I got to get this done. So this, you know, you'll get all the authors, some of the authors are real regular, but you know, sometimes A lot of times they may have been thinking about that project for a long time, and maybe based on something they did, and they may have been dicking around with it for a long time, and they finally got around to it. Often they finally got around to it because there was some kind of deadline going on, so they finally get it done, they get it to you kind of at the last minute. And then the problem with the publications is we also did news stories, and stuff that was coming out all the time, and the publication might represent 40 hours of work, and a news story might represent 3 hours of work, and that was usually timely, and so you'd drop the publication and do the news story, and then something else would come up in the publication. Because it's a big piece of work, it would always kind of get shunted back, so you'd be slow on it. So then you get to the designers, and they'd be, they have a large number of different things coming through, and they have a similar kind of thing. They have different pressures and different things that got to get done for people at different times. But, there's more expectation on them, more pressure on them, because they're late, they're slow. Why are we getting this done? And the fact is, everybody's been slow all along the line, but they're too close to the deadline. They need it to the printer. It's like, come on, we got to have it right away. And the printer's usually not my problem. It gave it to me at a certain time, so...
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting set of dynamics there, and I don't think it's changed that much.
Since we're on the topic of publications, I didn't write this down on the list, but are there going to be any special publications for the CALS 125?
I don't think we're going to do a special publication per se. We have our three times a year magazine, Grow Magazine. We're going to put there'll be a special article in there, which is going to be kind of like the looking at what happened over the last 25 years, because we tend to, when we do these histories, you tend to go back to the old things that were like the big, the Babcock Butterfat test and the discovery of vitamin D or the discovery of vitamins in general, or just all the kind of these standard things that were that the college has always hung your hat on. And often what happens is it's always harder to kind of celebrate the big things that have happened recently, because sometimes you don't know yet how big they are. You don't know how big they're going to be. But we got in the Grow Magazine, there's going to be a feature article that's going to focus on a dozen things that got done in the last, kind of like paradigm changes in a lot of cases. For example, I did a brief thing for that on climate change. And in 1989, when the college was 100 years old, there was basically the only stuff being done on climate on campus is being done by climatologists, and they're talking about whether or not climate change is happening, but there wasn't a lot of reaction to it. Now, and you fast forward now, and there's not a department on the campus, not a department of the college that's not doing something about climate change. So it's an example of the kind of paradigm shift you had over the last 25 years. We're working on that. And beyond that, I think we're just trying to get all the different units in the college that are doing something have any kind of event to just kind of tie that into the 125th anniversary.
Okay. Well, I think the next place I wanted to go, I might skip the technology question and just sort of see how that goes. Again, in your bio, you had a line about starting the website and then helping to sort of maintain it at least until the mid-2000s.
Yeah, those all two fit in together pretty well, website and technology. It's kind of this period... Again, this paradigm shift to how information is getting out. I would say the college, the websites generally were coming on in the early 90s. I don't know when the university put its first website up, the UW-Madison Central website, and I think we put our first up when probably around 1992, something like that, or in the early 90s. What tended to happen was websites are easier to do the smaller your unit is. It's still true because you just have a smaller story to tell. And so I think departments in a lot of cases were doing them before the larger unit, the college or the university wide, got done. I think one of the first websites on campus was pretty good was Department of Plant Pathology, because what happens is you get somebody in that area that's really interested in doing it. So. So sometime around then, the CALS Research Division wanted to have a website, and so I can't remember who the dean was at the time, but I think there was some graduate student in molecular biology had done a website they thought was pretty hot, which didn't take much in those days. Just having one was hot. And so they hired this guy to graduate student, like everybody who'd ever done a website, the graduate student started his own little company to do a website, which meant he did a website out of his bedroom. But so he created this basic website for the it was going to be for the research division, but it got to be basically the kind of a basic website, starting with just a main page for the college, which is just College of Ag and Life Sciences, and then the links to it. Immediately after that got done, there still is a fellow in Nikhil's computing lab in the animal sciences basement, Tom DeBoney, who's a information technology guy, and I worked together and reworked that website. So we started back then, and it was really basic stuff back then. You'd write it in HTML code, which wasn't very complicated, but you had to write in the HTML code. They didn't have like what you see, what you get kind of editors much in those days. And so we just basically put it up and it'd be like a picture and then a link. And it always had to have links to links. They weren't thinking about users. We weren't thinking about users. You just think about, all the different units in the department wanted to make sure they had their name in the front. So it was, that was the early days of it. And then some point not too far on into there, we started putting all of our news releases on there. So our news releases still, that's kind of our archive of news releases, goes back to the early 90s, because we were able to do that, which has been, makes a nice archive of those things. And there have been a zillion iterations of it over the year. I was actively involved in that website probably until the, early part of the 2000s. We hired a really good web guy for the information program, specifically for web stuff, in probably about 2005, and that was kind of a sea change in the level of quality that we had. He was very sharp about what he did and very thoughtful and thinking a lot about the users. So there's no end of web stuff.
Mm-hmm. What do you think overall the web did for your work or for the work at Cal's Communications?
Well, it's hard to even think back to what it was like before we had the web. It's true for everybody, whether you do communications or use the communications. We don't send out paper press releases anymore because you can deliver it all through the internet. Stuff that you do now, it's not ephemeral. You send out a press release to do a publication or something like that for a specific event, and it just kind of goes in there and ends up in a file drawer, gets thrown away. But now it's always out there and people can search it and find it, so makes it that way. So it makes it a lot more convenient in a lot of senses. We can get a lot of stuff out in a lot more places. We talk about the paper publications. They don't do paper publications anymore, and that I think a lot of that backlog, still people complain about stuff, but we don't do extension publications in the college anymore, but I know extension publications are all out there, and they do them as PDFs. They don't really print them on paper to speak of. If they do, they print them on demand. These are all ideas that, the idea of printing on demand was hard to imagine at those point. You just decide how many of these things are we going to need. We need 2,000. We'll print 2,000. We might throw away 1,100 a couple of years later. So it's made it much richer and phenomenally more easy in a lot of ways. I think the challenge is there's just so much more information out there. There's so much noise, so many people saying so many different things that it can be more of a challenge to get your word known, get your word, when you have stuff out there. So that's why people are using social media and trying to generate, churn the thing and get more active and more attention to it all the time. It's like you tweet, you hope the reporters will see, the reporter follows 1,500 people, maybe they'll see your thing, or maybe they'll see somebody else will see your thing and get it to them. So it's a totally different world.
And you mentioned in your your bio that you had worked with, and then we talked about it, you know, 6-7 deans. I guess my first question is, in general, did you have direct, either working, you know, direct relationship, working relationship with deans?
If I see any of those deans on the street, they'll know, we'll say hi, we'll talk, you know. So yes, I mean, I was, I worked with all of them and still see some of them at various events and chat with them. So I didn't, until about 2006, I was not based in Ag Hall. My boss was based in Ag Hall. I was mostly in the Ag Journalism building, 440 Henry Mall. So, but we would come up here for various projects, and you know, we worked for a guy that worked right under the dean, and so, which essentially is the same situation we have now. And you know, we write stories that involve the dean. So, yeah, I worked. I wasn't 40 feet from the dean like I am now, but I, you know, we still worked with him. Yeah, it was 6 or 7 deans. Started, Leo Walsh was here. He was the dean, and then he was replaced on an interim basis by Neil Jorgensen from Dairy Science, and then they hired Roger Weiss as the permanent replacement for him. And Roger was here a relatively short period of time. Neil was probably interim dean for a short period of time, and then Roger Weiss relatively had some ethical issues and was asked to step aside. So then Neil Jorgensen came back in. So Neil Jorgensen was never like hired as a dean, but he's got his picture on the wall as a dean because he was a dean a lot. So I'd count him too. And then Abe Aberle got hired, came in from Nebraska, and he was here. I can't remember when he retired. Animal scientist, and then we had an interim dean. I think it was Dave Hogg from entomology, and then we had Molly John, and then we had Bill Tracy as an interim dean when Molly was here for 4 years or so, and then. Now we have Keith Vandenbosch. So, yeah, and I've still see it. Never see Roger Weiss anymore, but I've seen all those other people from time to time, and everybody's different. Everybody's got a different personality.
And you alluded to this earlier, but in terms of publications, it would be, you know, if the dean needed something, you know, press release or whatever, or a publication, then that's what you would work on.
Yeah, I didn't usually get my, you know, if there was something involving the dean, and it was usually, yeah, that kind of thing would get done first. I mean, if there was something new in the college, you might talk to the dean or interview the dean, or in some way they'd be included in it, sure. Yeah, there were publications, there were lots of publications that were, the 100th anniversary of the college, they did a variety of publications strategic publications, strategic planning publications, views of the future, addressing different issues. There's all kinds of stuff, you know. 1985, I've just been doing a project related to this. 1985, they created the Dairy Task Force, 1995, because the dairy industry was going, Wisconsin dairy industry was going south in those days, and so they brought in all these people from all around the, everybody in the dairy industry, they created a task force. And so, you know, the top administrators were involved in that because that's kind of a key issue. And so there were lots of college people. Nobody from the college, I don't think, was on the task force proper, but somebody was like the executive secretary and the technical committee. And so projects like that, those always involved the administrator because those were high-profile things. And I got the report from that thing on my desk somewhere right now, the 75 recommendations. Now the industry's turned around, so we were successful.
So that was the 1985 future of
Dairy Task Force. 1995. It was created in 1985 and turned out its report in 1987, but that was kind of like, you know, it's kind of like now they've got a, you know, Dairy 20x30 or 30x20. It's like, what are we going to get done by 2020, you know? So mm-hmm. They're always like looking a few years ahead.
So, but created in 95 and the first iteration came out in 80, a publication came out in 87.
The task force started in 1985. Their first set of recommendations came out in like 1987. And they had 75 recommendations that were like everything from, you know, all over the college up and down. You know, everybody has anything to do with dairy, you know. Dairy products, forage, soil fertilizer, manure management, dairy policy, dairy price marketing, that kind of stuff. It was all over the board, and because it was, you know, there was a lot of different things to address.
Did you end up editing that before publication, or was that just?
I'm sure I did. You know, I've pulled the thing out and I've looked at it, and I'm quite sure that my colleague Diane Deering across the hall probably did the cover for it. That, you know, this was how printing was in those days. The cover is a very nice, you know, I don't think it's four color, but it's a, you know, it's a nicely glossy publication, and the inside of it is typewritten, like it was type was set by typewritten, so that was kind of like quick and dirty in those days. Now we'd do something like that and be all done on digital printing, and the whole thing would look pretty good. But yeah, I'm sure I edited that there in some respect. I can remember sitting in on the side of some of those meetings, so yeah. I can't remember actually doing it, but I'm sure I did, because I would have been the person who did.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe one more thing on deans. So were there deans who would want to write their own stuff and then you would edit that, or was it stuff sort of created for them under their name?
Well, a lot of what the deans, like dean speeches, that kind of stuff, my boss, Len Maurer, most of that time was the assistant or associate dean for external relations, and so, and that's the case now. My boss now is Heidi Zorbin. If they had speeches and things like that, they would write that kind of stuff. It'd be more for us. There'd be a project would come down from the. Some deans were like to write more than others. Some deans wanted to have somebody write stuff for them. Some deans are pretty good writers and love themselves. Some of them were terrible writers. I don't think I'm going to get into those details here, but you know, people were, some had more skills than others in writing, and some people had more interest in writing themselves, but everybody needs an editor. Some people just don't know it. Some do. Even editors need editors. Some were a lot more fun to work with than others. They're all very different personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, there was a kind of a transition, you know, there'd be, you know, Leo Walsh and Abe Aberle and Neil Jorgensen. Those were farm people. They came out of farms and worked in production agriculture departments, and there was just, you know, there's been the real cusp, you know, from people being farm-based people to not farm-based people over that, the period of time I've been here. It's like when you first came, it was like, that was kind of the core, and that's not true anymore.
Anything else you want to say about deans before we move on?
I could go on forever, but probably not.
So I think I want to talk about, we sort of talked about technology in terms of the web. We've talked about the research reports, deans. So maybe to go a step below deans to just in general folks that you have interacted with on campus. After the first interview, we talked off tape, so to speak, about sort of campus characters. I'm wondering if there's any people that you've worked with that stand out in your mind for whatever reason.
Well, there's a long list, endless list of campus characters, you know, and you've got the kind of the high-profile campus characters like the deans or like the, you know, the star professors. They didn't talk about star or superstar professors like, you know, 30 years ago like they do now, but you had those people, and then you've got kind of all the, you know, all the backstory of all the people supported them, and, you know, they're all interesting. It's kind of hard to narrow them down, you know. It's, I can talk about the people in ag journalism. It was a pretty interesting cast of characters there. Let's see, and we had in the basement, we had Fritz Elbert was a filmmaker, passed away recently. He was a very well-known filmmaker. He came over from Germany. He was actually got hired by William Sumner, who was one of the earliest leaders in that department, went over after World War II and brought him back. Fritz had made, like, been working for the Germans in the war, making films during the war, but he was, he came here and made films for 30 years, a whole real wide variety of films, and he was, and then he hired Wolfgang Hoffmann. He brought Wolfgang over from Germany, took him right out of photography school or something, brought him over. Wolfgang came over on the a freighter right into the Great Lakes. Have you interviewed Wolfgang?
Mm.
He'd be a great oral history. I'm sure he'd like to talk. So you had Fritz and Wolfgang in the basement, and they were kind of like this father-son relationship, and they were like, got along or didn't get along all these years, but those guys would go all over the state traveling, you know, they knew all the back roads and all the diners, and back in those days, they turned out just dozens and dozens. Sometimes they'd take a year to make a film, sometimes they'd make four in a year, and they were the kind of stuff that nowadays you'd probably, a teacher in an elementary school or a high school would take off of the internet or something like that, but those days they were just all the films that they used to show in school classes. There would be things about agriculture and natural resources and all kinds of stuff like that. Yeah, that film program kind of faded away when video came on, probably in sometime in the 90s. So Wolfgang stayed around for a long time. I mean, he still does freelance for us, but he stopped doing video. But yeah, those are very strong personalities, and they had a darkroom person down there named Lubusha Saporzek, who was Czechoslovakian. So it was kind of like our European contingent in the basement. They were always they were like a little family squabbling and not squabbling. And other end of the hall, you had Pete Willoughby, who was the guy, the assistant professor in charge of exhibits, who was a pretty strange character in and of himself. Very creative guy, but kind of nuts in a lot of ways. He got divorced sometime in the early 90s. Or late 80s or something like that. Anyway, so he was, during that time, he was kind of between houses, and so he had a workshop in the basement of Ag Journalism. It's where that little cafe is down there now. There was a period of about 9 months when he was actually living down there. He had a little office, and he had a workshop, and he worked out his own little security system, had a little pad down there, a little bench with a little pad, and he had a shower set up in the workshop. And this is the kind of thing that everybody knew, but nobody, not everybody knew, but it was pretty widely known, but people didn't, and then he was courting a lot of ladies in those days, so he just spent a lot of his time not actually in that space, but... And then up the other end, the top of the building, the one end, we had Larry Mueller, and who we still have, Larry Mueller and Margaret Andreessen were our talk radio people. The university radio started with farm radio, farm and home economics radio, and those are Larry Mueller and Margaret Andreessen. They're basically the kind of the end of that. You know, Larry still does a noontime radio show, but that started out as the farm show, which was his predecessor was Maury White, who also did the farm show, and he was like Larry's mentor. So you had Larry and Margaret did the 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock shift on public on WHA, doing a talk radio show. And here was, they had a article once on Madison talk radio hosts, and they talked about the different people. And remember, they said Margaret was the resident intellectual, and Larry was a genial veteran. They cast him, so somebody in the department put up signs above the door. Larry said, genial veteran, and Margaret was resident intellectual. But they had one thing in common, is that they just had huge piles of papers on top of their desks. Margaret is more, was a chronic, more a bigger issue with Larry, with Margaret than it was with Larry. Margaret was the kind of situation where, like, her desk could get piled to the point like a dome, you know, where you could get to the point where you put another piece of paper on there, it would slide off. You couldn't, it was always like that. She had stuff piled around the side, but her desk was always like that. Larry was like that too, not quite as bad. You know, Larry is still on campus and he still has a pretty messy desk, but it's not quite as bad as it used to be. But it was, and Dick Powers was a professor in those days who was, he was kind of the heart and soul of the department in a lot of ways. He was very sweet. He was, he taught statistics to a lot of people like me who didn't understand statistics and didn't need a lot of statistics, but he was like kind of, he would kind of get them through that. And he was, he would oversaw the news service for a while. He was, I think, probably a lot of people look back, more students probably look back with affection at Dick Powers than anybody else. He was kind of like, I kind of identify him, because in those days, he was the guy that had been around forever. If you wanted to know about something that happened in the past, he would sit there and, oh yeah, it was old such and such, and oh yeah, that happened to old such and such. He'd look at a picture and identify all the people, and he was kind of like, in fact, he was kind of interesting. When I got there in the early 80s, and he was later in the 80s, he wrote the 100th anniversary publication about the college, and it was perfectly appropriate for him because he'd written the 75th anniversary. And I thought, boy, that was really weird that he was like had been there 25 years later and he was doing it again. Of course, now I was there for the 75th anniversary, and I mean, I was there for the 100th anniversary, and now here I am for the 125th anniversary. So now I see a different perspective on that. So,
Bob, thank you for all that. I do want to ask, too, because I now remember who you were talking about. You were talking about
Byron Jorns?
Yeah, you were talking about the guy whose art, at least three or four pieces, adorn your wall here.
Yeah, I did not know Byron Jorns. He died well before I was around, but there were a number of people around who remembered him, and his stuff was all around. Byron's, and there, you know, people... people remember him like John Ross, who's he's still alive. He was an emeritus professor, and he remembered him from when he was a student back in the 50s. And I know Tom Wright, who's the research, who's the director of the Ag Research, West Madison Ag Research Station. His father was on campus, and his father used to go out with Byron Jorns. Byron Jorns was like a pretty interesting character. He's an illustrator. He illustrated all the publications we're talking about back in the days when before he had a lot of photographs, he had a lot more pen and ink kind of stuff. And he also illustrated all the covers. You see these extension publications with pen and ink illustrated covers. He did those. Those things are kind of classics now. And he also, he did, you know, some of them were like fairly elaborate things, and then some were just, he did like these scratchboard things, you know, and very elaborate things. And then he did... just really basic stuff. He illustrated up. We still have a lot of illustrations around here now about how you, the correct way to wire a plug. And so we've got all this whole series of illustrations, you know. You've got the illustration of the plug and the wires and how they get twisted and everything. They had a whole series of stuff like that. They're very mundane things, but it's pretty cool, the fact that he did this stuff and, you know, hand drew it and everything. Now I think it's kind of classic stuff. So did a lot of illustrations of he did a series of things of buildings on campus. Some of those are on the wall now, like the Stock Pavilion and the Bascom Hill and Bascom Hall and the Carolyn Tower and I think he did the horse barn and all kinds of stuff like that. He did a whole series of those. And he also was he did watercolors, a lot of watercolors around Wisconsin, scenes in Wisconsin. And some of those are collected. Some of those, my understanding, he's got stuff in the Chicago Art Institute. And he did a calendar there was a calendar, a wildlife calendar he did that was pretty well known. And there's a very interesting story. I mean, it's in Byron Jorns is a very interesting story. It's one of those ones that I would like to see explored more.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about how he has done art or illustrations on some buildings. You have some here in the office. It reminds me of the fact that, and you alluded to this or you said it, were in Ag Hall, but that wasn't your, you weren't always in Ag Hall.
No, the when I was a student, ag journalism was actually based in the basement of Ag Hall, where landscape architecture is now. And when I was working as a, when I was working as a, as in my summer jobs working for Ag Journalism, they were based in the basement of Ag Hall. I came back as a student in the early 70s, and sometime in the early 70s they moved down to 440 Henry Mall, the middle building on the west side of Henry Mall. That was the Ag Journalism building for probably 30 years or so. And so most of my time that I worked, I was in the second floor office of 440 Henry Mall. It was a former lab. It used to be part of the lab complex of Joshua Lederberg, the later to win a Nobel Prize geneticist. And so I, my office for about 20 years was basically a long, narrow, what used to be graduate student labs. And there was like, you know, wooden counter along both sides, and little lights under the counter you could turn on and off that they'd use to like look at petri dishes. And it was never really got remodeled. Just had, you know, students, ag journalism students were in there after genetic students, and then it just became my office. And I remember we had a guy come in from building and from the planning and building department, and one time we talked about getting remodeling. He said, oh yeah, I can remember. He said his very first job had been designing that one, setting that up in the first place. He said, yeah, Lederberg wanted to get this done as cheaply as possible. Mm-hmm. So, it was plywood cabinets, and it was asbestos wall board, that just the boards up there, wasn't taped between the boards. They were just screwed up on the walls. So. But yeah, it was that was my space. That was where Ag Journalism was. They were there until they created the biochemistry. And then we had two buildings for a long time. We were also based in Hiram Smith Hall. Our publications and mailing operation was over in Hiram Smith Hall. I had offices in both places.
And then you moved over here when?
We moved here. We actually moved from we moved out of Ag Journalism probably 2005. For 2 or 3 years they had us on the second or on the main floor of the Ag Engineering Building, or Biological Systems Engineering, because Ag Journalism had outgrown the space. Ag Journalism for a long time had our fast copy shop had moved from the Hiram Smith Hall to the first floor, former machinery shop and agricultural engineering. When that was vacated, they moved our fast copy. The Cal's fast copy shop was over there. So, and then when they got rid of that space, somehow we got rights to, I don't know, half of a large office up in Ag Engineering. We were there in cubicles for about 3 years. That was a great space, great department to be in. Had the best potlucks and really friendly department. I miss those guys. And then we moved up here in probably 2006, 2007. Somewhere around there. We've been up here for 4 years, I think.
And so you said earlier that you were going to do an update to the extension.
The Ag Research Station publication?
The Ag Research Station publication, which makes me...
Been promising that for a long time.
You said that's going to be one of the last things you do.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Is retirement on the horizon?
I'm anticipating retiring sometime in 2014. So, yeah, sometime toward the end of this year. I'm later rather than earlier this year. Yeah, that was a publication I've been promising for a long time, and I told them that... I wanted to get that one done. That's because it's a good project, and I'm putting it off forever. It's not the only reason I'm sticking around, but yeah, it's kind of done. But yeah, I think this is going to be the year. It's hard to figure out when to retire, period, because there's no real obvious time. There's no real obvious, from a financial standpoint, there's no real obvious cutoff time in terms of what I'm doing here. You know, I love being here. I love the people. You know, I've got a lot of friends, and I've spent more time, more years doing this than anything else in my life. And it's a very comfortable position for me. And I think I still add value here, but I think it's getting to be time. I am hoping that I can still keep my hand in some way. I'm hoping I'll get a chance to freelance for the magazine and maybe take on special projects, that kind of thing. But I think there are other things I want to do. There are some other stuff I'd like to do, at least get around to getting done. And I'd like to do it when I can still walk.
So what do you think, if put on the spot, what do you think your legacy would be? I mean, you're retiring this year. Your legacy here, for the work that you've done on campus.
Well, you know, there are some people where they can stand out and you can say their legacy. You know, you can look at Steenbach or DeLuca or somebody like that, and they've got this really signature thing, and they can point to it and it's like clearly identified with that one person. And it's hard to take my legacy of somebody like me or most people that working on campus and, you know, untangle it from the legacy of a lot of other people. So I'd say I think the communication program the college has now is a lot more sophisticated than it was when I started. Communication is a lot more sophisticated than it was back then, but I think we're closer toward the staying current. We're kind of behind for a long time, and I feel like we're a lot closer now. I'm not taking responsibility for that. I was part of the group that made that into place. You know, we didn't have video when they first had video. We didn't. There were a lot of, you know, we were kicking and screaming. There was a point when they wanted to put all the publications on CD, and we didn't want to do that. And, you know, of course, there were a lot of technologies that people like resisted, and then for good reason, because they never really came to be a fruition, like putting publications on CD. I mean, that was a pretty made a lot of sense at the time, but it didn't go that far. You know, there was a point when extension was like thoroughly, totally going to be into computer downlinks, and every extension office is going to have the satellite download, computer downlink thing, and like satellite download thing, and they were putting an enormous amount of money into that, and you know, it just kind of went poof after a while. But I think, you know, I'm pretty proud of the fact that now we look at the fact that we've got a really good, I think we're pretty good with internal communications with the ECALS newsletter, which, you know, it's not a perfect thing, and it doesn't get everything done, but I think it's really the core of a good way to get information out, in the sense that you're actually, every week we put a publication, an electronic publication, to get that out to people. And we were basically the first unit on campus that was able to do that week after week after week, coming up with this regular faculty and staff communication program. And when they came up, now they have the twice weekly Inside UW publication that was modeled after ECALS. They came down and talked to us before they did that. So, and I have to say, like most of the things we've accomplished, I was dragged kicking and screaming into that. I didn't particularly want to do it, but they gave that one to me. And you know, it's gotten better and better, mostly because we've had good technical people behind it. I think it's like a lot of these things. You build up over a period, you know, that creates a record of the stuff we've done here. You can go back and look over the 6 or 7 or 8 years, whatever it is we've done that, and you've got like this record of you know, important, not important things, but you kind of see the fabric of the college. So I think that's pretty cool. You know, we got a really pretty good website now. I think we've come a long way with that. We got a decent social media program for the size of the operation we have around here. We do, I'd say, a pretty We have a radio operation. There's always been a radio operation. That's another good example of technology. When I first came here, they were doing, or shortly before I came here, they were sending out radio shows to all of the radio stations around the state, and they sent them out on vinyl discs. They weren't doing that when I was there. When I got there, they were doing them on cassette tapes, but they'd have all these extension guys come in and talk, and they'd interview them 3 minutes about tax planning and 3 minutes about forage and 3 minutes about, you know, cleaning your cows out or whatever like that, and they put those together in a tape and they'd send those out. And so that's come a long way, because now C.B. Kenyon, my colleague, does something pretty similar every week, and he basically emails it to him. No, he puts it online and emails him the link, so it's just, you know, I think we're banging on all the cylinders. You know, we got a pretty good communication program. And, you know, so I didn't, it's not my legacy. I'm part of the group that can claim that legacy. You know, I mean, the communication's pretty interesting on campus. You think about it, you can go all the way back to Dean Henry in the days when Dean Henry and his, when they were like about six professors on campus and they were writing 200 letters a year to answer questions to farmers. And that's, you know, that was... got to be more and more of a burden for those guys to do their research when they couldn't, because they had you could either do the research or you can tell people about the research, and they're always doing that. You know, it's still that issue today, but so they basically more and more turned it over professionals. You know, hired their first agricultural editor, office of the agricultural editor, and that grew into the ag journalism department. So, you know, it's a very interesting transition. I'm happy to have been part of that whole legacy, tracing myself back to that. I can't point to it all by myself, but I think most of the stuff on campus is built by this broad intertwining network of hundreds of people, and I'm one of those, and that's how I describe my legacy.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for your time. You've given me these three sessions. I appreciate it. So this concludes the oral history with Bob Mitchell.